Greetings and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I am Bill Grant, co-chair of the club's Health and Medicine Member-Led Forum and chair of this program. And now it is my pleasure to introduce our distinguished speaker for today's program, Dr. Donald P. Francis. Dr. Francis, after completing undergraduate studies at the University of California at Berkeley, received his MD from Northwestern University and his Doctor of Science in Virology from Harvard. In addition, he completed his pediatric training at the University of Southern California Medical Center in Los Angeles and his infectious disease training at Harvard. He joined the CDC in the early 1970s, where he worked on smallpox eradication with WHO in India, Bangladesh, Sudan, and the former Yugoslavia. He combated cholera epidemic in Nigeria and the first Ebola outbreak in Sudan. Later, he was assistant director of the CDC's hepatitis division, conducting large efficacy studies of candidate hepatitis B vaccines in China and the United States. In 1981, he began his work on with HIV/AIDS. He's one of the first scientists to grasp the significance of the AIDS epidemic. His early work on HIV/AIDS was chronicled in And the Band Played On, journalist Randy Schultz's seminal account of the early years of the AIDS epidemic. In 1985, Dr. Francis was assigned to the state of California as CDC's AIDS advisor. In addition, from 1988 to 1992, he was special consultant on AIDS to San Francisco Mayor Art Agnos. Dr. Francis retired from the CDC in 1992 and began to work at Genentech, Inc. of South San Francisco to develop an HIV vaccine. In 1995, Dr. Francis co-founded a spinoff of Genentech called VaxGen, conducting the world's first efficacy trials in the United States, Canada, Holland, and Thailand. In 2004, Dr. Francis retired from VaxGen to establish a not-for-profit foundation, Global Solutions for Infectious Diseases, dedicated for developing vaccines for less developed parts of the world. Dr. Francis.
Thank you, Bill, and thanks for all of you coming in an evening to hear such a delightful story of diseases around the world. What I'm going to do is first give a relatively broad introduction to expand on what Bill just said about the history of HIV and that for someone who worked on really bad bugs around the world, coming back to the United States and having the disaster of the response to HIV was incredibly depressing. And ultimately led to me asking CDC to send me back home to California where I could at least do something against the disease before I would retire. And that was good, at least, but it was a, for those of you who've not read or seen the movie And the Band Played On, I suggest you do it because the revelation of what the Reagan administration did and subsequent Bush administration probably killed millions of people around the world by ignoring politically, you can ignore Ebola because it has a short incubation period, but politically, you can if you have a disease with a 10-year incubation period, what do you care as a politician if you have a 2-year term or 4-year term? By the time anything comes around, you'll be long retired. And it was we knew that at the time, unfortunately, and we could not convince these people to do anything about it. And unfortunately, the rest of the world looks towards the United States for these kinds of things and in many ways followed the same pattern. And so the world is suffering this huge problem that continues to this day. So I will review those early days, then talk about the development of a vaccine because the challenge, it's a bit of a discouraging story in that we have Joe Robinson here who worked with me at Genentech and VaxGen and now onwards, so he actually comes to hear the story, which surprises me because it's not a fun story. We've made progress, but it's been incredibly slow. But I'll talk about Genentech, VaxGen, and then GSID and the success. We at least had one partial successful trial now in Thailand and trying to carry on after literally, 2 decades of pursuit. So with that, I'll try this magic machine. Look at that. So here's the outline. I'm going to talk about the early AIDS history and then the concept of an HIV vaccine, the studies of for those of you not familiar with vaccine studies, phase 1 is safety, phase 2 is to see if it does the right immune response. And then the real difficulty are the phase three trials, where you go out with people at risk, with thousands of patients, and some get a placebo, some get the vaccine, and you see what happens after a few years of study. Huge, huge jobs, very, very difficult. And then another failed product down with the Merck AD4 vaccine, and then to end with at least some partial success today. Okay, let's go back in time, this remarkable outbreak. CDC has a weekly report called Morbidity and Mortality Weekly Report, down charming name down at the bottom of that slide. And this is the first, God, I think it was page 2, was not in the front page even, of these cases of pneumocystis pneumonia in Los Angeles, soon to be followed by a follow-up study showing the same disease in New York. And you see there that he had 5 healthy young men, and already 2 of them are dead. And this clearly got our attention at CDC, when even with a small outbreak like this, one, we've been studying diseases in gay men for many years and knew the remarkable propensity they had of spreading difficult-to-transmit bugs. So we jumped on this very, very early on because of the dangers. And then you got 2 years later, with work that was remarkably done, that we worked very closely with a small group at the Institut Pasteur of Françoise Barré-Sinoussi, the first author on the paper, to isolate a virus out of these patients that ended up to be the cause of AIDS. And this was a remarkable finding, and Françoise and Luc Montagné got the Nobel Prize for this just a few years ago. And then, this is realized it started in 1981, and so in 1984, CDC asked me to pull myself out of the lab and to design a response to this dangerous bug, a prevention program for the United States of America, and I think it was, what, $30, $40 million to educate people about the disease and give them advice that we had worked with these groups for years and years about how not to get it. And this went up to the Reagan administration, and we got a note back that it's not been funded, and literally saying lines like, look pretty and do as little as you can. At this point, I'd been with CDC for, 14 years, and I asked to be sent to home and came back to California. and started out making the same programs that we have now step by step in California, but finding the money mostly from state because the feds were not interested in doing it at that time, which meant spent much of my time in Sacramento with Joe Robinson, who's here, and Mark Conant, raising legislative, if you can imagine, dealing with an epidemic where we had to write laws and budgets, which take months and years to do. Was incredibly damaging to the, it was good in the sense that it was done, but very damaging in terms of public health because the response ended up to be very, very late. And this, if you're interested, is the first Jim Chin, who was a state epidemiologist in California with whom I worked, and I wrote this, really the first prevention manuscript. This is 1987 now, 6 years into the epidemic, about prevention of AIDS. In JAMA, a very, very long article dealing with all of the various risk groups and what to do. And this is the line that starts it out, that I think for those of us who've worked in really dangerous viruses, HIV is one of the most virulent infectious agents ever encountered. And that's actually true. There are very few bugs we have that untreated kill close to 100% of the people. This is more dangerous than Ebola. And much more dangerous because it's got a long incubation period, and therefore you don't see it, and by the time you find it, it's spread elsewhere and has a much larger group of infected individuals, infectious individuals, and short of treatment, which we had none early on, essentially everyone who had the disease died. So this was all chronicled, interestingly, about 1987. Randy Schultz, a wonderful reporter for the San Francisco Chronicle, who ultimately died of HIV, published a book in the band played on. And when that came out, the administration in Washington sent CDC a note to fire me because I spoke the truth about what, and it was in the book, about what had happened historically. And fortunately, I had, by that time, a whole long list of people like Art Agnos and Bill Fagey and Jonas Salk who shot back at the Reagan administration. They left me alone for a few more years until I retired from CDC in 1992. And with that retirement, wrote things like this commentary of how the AIDS policy in the United States had killed so many people, so that you can have these for your records should you want them. And then finally the movie comes out in 1993, the book, and in the right there is Matthew Modine, who starred in the movie, who played, of all things, Don Francis. And at that point, I can leave and start working on, since the prevention side was so hard, looking at how we can deal with this short of trying to change behavior. And that was the possibility, since this was a virus, of making a vaccine. We had, when the talent that really led to the founding of organizations like Genentech was really knowing what DNA technology is and how we could take these very dangerous viruses and make pieces of them as necessary, that we think the immune system would recognize and make a vaccine from these pieces that have no chance of being infectious and cause, one, they're safe, and they can cause a very good immune response that is presumably protective. So in the first 3-4 years, I worked at Genentech after retiring, and then Genentech says, this is difficult, this AIDS vaccine work. Do you want to, we don't want it, we want to move it out, and would you take it? And I said, sure, you know, I'll start a company. I've never started a company in my life. And went out and raised the millions and millions of dollars it takes to do a company and started VaxGen and ran the studies, and then it goes on after that, and we still have that vaccine. This is the concept. In the top, you see HIV. In the upper left, with the little blue balls, is the GP120. It's a glycoprotein of 100,000 molecular weight for you chemists in the audience. And that binds to the cell surface, where you see the little receptors there of the T cells, and goes in and infects the cell. And the concept was, if we can make and take that little ball, make it by recombinant technology, use it as a vaccine, and produce antibodies, which are the little yellow things in the bottom that stick to it and prevent the virus from being able to infect the cell, you'll have a success. And indeed, that is a very good concept and was started very early at Genentech, as I will show you. On the left side of this is Genentech, and then the right side is VaxGen when we spun it out. And this was remarkable because this was the first time that we could show protection from this vaccine. Either good news or bad news, the only animal we had were very, very high primates, essentially chimpanzees, that are susceptible to HIV and from where HIV came originally. And that they're very expensive. People don't like to experiment with chimps, but luckily we had enough people who were gutsy enough to do it, and we did vaccine studies with chimpanzees where we vaccinated them and then challenged them with HIV. And we showed protection from the vaccine. Now, the challenge there is that HIV is quite variable, and so we challenged them with the same virus from which the vaccine was made and showed protection. And there's later studies in there where we actually took one that was quite varied and still showed protection. And so we were optimistic that this might work in humans. And there's a gap there. What is it, when Genentech said, do you want to take it out, it was 1993, and by the time we raised the money and built the company, it was 4 years later before we could actually start the further chimp studies, then ultimately the phase 1, phase 2 studies of a vaccine for Thailand and a vaccine for North America and Europe. And those long trials on the right, the BB phase 3 trial is the one for United States and Europe, and the BE vaccine and was addressing the strains in Thailand, which is B and E, and those are the ones in Bangkok. This is a map of where we were in the United States. These are not easy things to do, and you have these multi-center trials all over the United States and Holland for the primarily gay men and IV drug users in Thailand. These are the number of people it takes to do a trial. In North America and Europe, we had 5,400 people, and in Thailand, 2,500. The reason the difference, if you look at the next line down, or it's two lines down, you see the rate of infection, where in the United States was estimated to be 1.5% per year, and in Thailand, 4%. So if you got a higher rate, your number of people in your trial you need is smaller. And they started in mid-1998 and 1999, and went to 2003. So they are long, difficult, and challenging studies to do. And you wait to the end, they're all blinded. You have a group that's a placebo and a group that is vaccine. You don't know who it is until the end of the study. At the end of the study, you break the code and see how many infections occur in the vaccine versus the placebo group. And Thailand was a total loss. And IV drug users, almost exactly the same number of infections in the vaccine group and the placebo group. Was very discouraging. And then the U.S., North American, European trial was very interesting in that there was a suggestion of efficacy in, interestingly, non-white volunteers, where there was considerable efficacy in African Americans, but not enough to make a licensed product. And so overall, it was very difficult and hard to deal with. So the summary was that we had a successful trial. The treatment groups were balanced and looked perfectly fine statistically. There was no efficacy overall in the trial, but the subgroup analysis of African-Americans and non-whites and women looked like there was efficacy in the North American trial. And so the question was how to move on. And it's difficult. Here's what it costs to do these things. If you look at the investment on the left and the capital sources on the right, it cost us almost $300 million to do these studies and to start manufacturing in Celltrion in Korea. That was going to be our manufacturing partner. And the source of that was primarily private capital. This is a very discouraging start of this study. We were expecting that NIH would fund these studies, as did Chiron, the other vaccine company in the United States that was making a vaccine, and Tony Fauci, who is the director of National Institutes of Allergy and Infectious Disease, and now still in that game in a big way, decided off his cuff this was not something that NIH wanted to fund and force, and that's why the gap between Genentech and Vaxgen. When that occurred, Genentech didn't want to do it anymore, and so 3 years went by before all the tens of thousands of infections that occurred during each one of those years when the U.S. government did not want to support vaccine studies. And that really is an issue that we can discuss afterwards of NIH as a research institution and who's going to do applicatory research like vaccines, because it's if they can't get papers published in a year or so, they're not necessarily interested in doing these things. So it's a very difficult issue. These phase three trials are long, complex, time-consuming, and expensive, and they are held to raise money for when in the private sector. So then what happens? Well, next we get this, quote, this new vaccine with Merck. It was an adenovirus 5 construct. That's why it's AD5 at the top. That was, everyone was very excited about this new vaccine, and so there was a large study in North America, South America, and the Caribbean, and then a follow-up study later in South Africa with almost 4,000 volunteers for this study. And the Data Safety and Monitoring Board that looked at this study and advised the people and were suddenly very, very concerned that the rate of infection in the vaccinees looked higher than the rate of infection in the placebo group. And so this was halted by safety, which was obviously a very discouraging thing. And then comes this fascinating study where here we have the U.S. Army coming to us and to Sanofi and saying, we would like to do a trial in Thailand, and this time in heterosexual at-risk people in southern Thailand, and would you supply vaccine for this study? And it would be a prime boost with the Sanofi vaccine being a prime on the first doses and then boosted with our recombinant protein vaccine of the outer envelope of the virus. And we said, sure, we'll do this. And Were we excited about it? Not necessarily, because we were also discouraged. And was this really going to work? There was some evidence that it might be a little bit better. But anyway, we went ahead and did it. These are the two vaccines. It's the Alvac at the top. The CP is a canary pox strain of the virus. They put the proteins of HIV onto it. And the HVAX BE is ours, which is, as I mentioned, just the recombinant protein from the envelope that we make with Chinese hamster ovary cells, like many of the recombinant proteins are. And this is the two there, the CM244 and the MN, are North American and Thai strains of the virus that we use. And see, the trial started in 2003, so another 6 years go by in 2009 for the results of this. And here's the reference, if the guys want it, of the study. This was interesting. This is the first successful HIV, or partially successful HIV vaccine, but it was the first time that a HIV vaccine was shown that would actually work. And it was published in the New England Journal, 2009? And here's the study design. You'll see it is very large. You start with 26,000 people and ultimately put them into two different groups of at the bottom there, one 8,000 each, one vaccine and one placebo, and advise them not to have any sexual risk-taking behavior, and then follow them through the period of the trial. And this is the vaccines. Our vaccine is the two little green syringes at the top. It was supposed to be three with a boost, and the boost, for various reasons, never hurt, which was a shame, as you will see from the results. And the canary pox is the white syringes where you see the prime with the canary pox and the boost with our vaccine, and then followed for 3+ years. And this are the two curves of the vaccine in green and the placebo in red. And if there was no effect of the vaccine, the two lines would be exactly like red right on the top. And you see very early with the doses of vaccine that the green line starts diverging from the red, and you get protection in the vaccine, which almost approached 50% protection in the first year, but we didn't give a boost. And so overall, as the protection declined over time, there's about a 30% protection. But this is the first time in the history of any HIV vaccine that there was actual protection. So now the question is what to do and how to move on now with this partially effective vaccine very exciting in many ways and yet very hard to think about, especially from a either not-for-profit or for-profit to raise the money to do this. It is probably not a profitable market, and therefore it's been financially difficult, surprising. I'm sure you'll be surprised to hear that you have an AIDS vaccine, and it's really been tough to move it forward. But the first thing is to understand and put a lot of lab work into. We have all these specimens from these people, and we're shipping them all around the world, trying to figure out exactly what the vaccine did and how it failed. And then to think about repeat trials in Thailand, and then either ours or someone else's looking at Southern Africa. So that's good news and bad news. This is the overall timeline. If you look at the left-hand side of this, it starts in 1984, and the right-hand side of that is literally today. And you see how long it takes and how all this time and money and energy it takes to do this, especially it's a difficult it's a difficult scientific challenge. But I think equally difficult to me is the political and commitment that we have lots of support and interest in drugs in this country for therapies. But when you think about the real tools that take care of disease, it's prevention and vaccines. And it's very difficult to get that kind of interest and sexy fundraising for long-term products like vaccines compared to short-term drugs. And that is a disease of the United States of America in spades, in that I was raised in Marin County, and we have Marin County housewives talking about not vaccinating their children because it hurts them. They just haven't seen the disease that I see around the world all the time, and they're wonderful tools. And so we don't put our money into it, and we don't want to put a needle in a baby. So we get what we deserve, to be honest. Okay, in conclusion, vaccine development is difficult, time-consuming, and expensive. HIV vaccine is especially expensive, time-consuming, and difficult. And although that we've had some progress, it on the whole, I think it's been exciting and that we had success, and frustrating in the lack of a commitment that we see for as a not-for-profit of people lining up and saying, you guys can make vaccines, why don't you make it better? And we are doing it, but literally years go by between one step and the end. For those that are interested, there's an article in Biologics that I published that goes this whole subject of the goods and bads of vaccines and how wonderful they are and how challenging they are to make. That's it. So now we can have questions of everything from Ebola to whatever.
Thank you.
I have heard numbers like it takes $1 billion to $2 billion to develop a vaccine. If you were to break down the cost, is it on the different trials that where the cost goes in, or is it just the technical?
Well, it's really both, but the laboratory technical piece is small. It's when you get, if you look at the curve of a vaccine development, your phase, the initial stuff, phase one, phase two are going up, and then when you get to phase three, and that was all that money there really was for the phase three trials. These are expensive things to do because you have thousands of patients and all these sites and the volunteers and the follow-up and the laboratory work. So it's, I think your estimate's correct. I think you're talking today, this is 500 million, I mean, this was 200 some million of ours, but you're lucky to get through with a vaccine in 500 million or a billion nowadays. And so but that's trivial in terms of the cost of AIDS. Trivial. There's lots of money for this vaccine for the United States, Western countries where you can make lots of money. And that's the way this vaccine business works. It's silly in a way, but you make your money charging lots of money to get a return on your investment in the industrialized world, and then you move the vaccines out to less developed countries. Now, some of the reasons I think you see Big Pharma not wanting this is they would really prefer not to have an HIV vaccine. It's like having a tiger by the tail. You can make money in the industrialized world, but everyone will complain. They're not at risk, yada, yada, yada. You'll be fighting that. And you'll have the developing countries screaming for it. And so you end up with why would you put the money in this when you can put a cancer drug or something that you'll give another 6 months of life to an 80-year-old person where you can get lots and lots of money? Yeah.
Elaborate more on the scientific strategy being employed in order to find an HIV vaccine, especially as to why the glycoprotein 120 is being pursued so heavily?
Well, because any time you have a virus infecting a cell, almost always it's antibody to whatever part of the virus is going to touch the cell to go in that causes protection. So that if you can get antibodies to that, and as that cartoon showed, block the entrance of the virus into the cell, you should have success. The challenge is if that outer coat protein is changing all the time, then you have 500 different viruses and you have your vaccine is against three of them. And then you have to make the other 400 and some strains in your vaccine, it becomes incredibly expensive and impossible. So you have to find more of a virus that represents a lot more, much more of the virus is circulating. And that's probably true of many places in the world, and certainly in Africa. Anytime viruses circulate for a long time, they all change, and so you end up chasing your tail. Look at influenza. Many of the people in the room, including me, we get immunized with influenza every year. Why? Because that silly thing, you know, you get two chickens and a pig coughing in the same room, and you end up with a whole new strain, and it's a real pain in the backside. I'm on the WHO flu committee, and I've always hated that disease. And how I got on this committee, I don't know. I just hate it. It's after you've eradicated smallpox, to work on flu is just horrible.
I'm just a common man. I have a couple of questions. First of all, is this virus a new virus or something that has been around for a long time and has just we've just become aware of? And I'm talking before the initial infections that came to light in the public. And my second question is, you mentioned earlier that this started in chimpanzees. Does the virus exist in such a way that it can infect both simians and humans, or did this somehow migrate from chimpanzees to the humans, and how did that happen?
Yeah, we think all the data points that this is an old virus of chimps. I did kill a couple of chimps with the virus, but they are generally much more tolerant of the virus in the wild in Africa. And it's an old chimp virus in Africa, and it will not go to lower animals. So it really is a chimp, in contrast to if we get to Ebola, which can go in all different ways. This is a very high, you got to lose your tail to be susceptible to HIV. We can't use monkeys even to test it. You have to use chimps. And so it's a chimp virus. It's circulated forever. And chimp, much like what you see from the Ebola story with people who slaughter animals ultimately getting infected and then gets into humans and in the hospitals, same thing with HIV. This was probably a very common rural infection in Africa, chimpanzee families. And the husband would get infected, infect the wife, they'd both die. Maybe a child would die, but in Africa that would hardly be noticed. And that's where it stayed until people moved to cities. And once they moved to cities, then all it took was one chimpanzee butcher to come in, left his wife, moved to the cities to work in Central Africa, and prostitutes came in to service him, and the rest of it is history.
Thank you. I'm curious if there was, say, social capital to have multiple very large simultaneous global studies going on, and if there was the political capital or private capital to fund these, would there be the capacity of innovation to come up with many, many concurrent phase 3 trials, you know, before that it's phase 1 and things like that? Like, are there enough ideas? Is there an abundance of ideas in the lab of, oh, we could try this, but we know that you only get to try maybe one or two major trials every several years, so the labs have to pick that one or that two particular things to make it that far?
Well, I think there's several pieces of that. I'll bet we could do 6 efficacy trials now if you had enough money to work on 6 different products that would probably be very, very well. I think the research community would support that as a good approach, maybe 10. But you don't want to come up with tons of money out there and try everything until you've gone through the projectile vomiting test. Will it actually get to be a product, or is this a research? We're not talking about research. This is the issue that I just touched on just briefly, the difference between research, and this is what the National Institutes of Health support, and product development, that we turn to the private sector. And we don't have this bridging money to do what you ask. There should be, and you get NIH. Yes, NIH will do it. NIH doesn't, not for, at least in our experience, Tony Fauci and Kraut, they're interested in doing research, and they love doing research. Let them do laboratory research to come up with the ideas for these vaccines. But we do need an institute of, like our last trial. Who funded that trial? The U.S. Army. There's somebody that knows how to do practical vaccine research. And you need to have some group that does this kind of stuff and get it out of the power structure of the National Institutes of Health so that you can have product development from the products that the National Institutes of Health supported research uncovers. But could you do, I think you could probably have 10, 12, 20 trials going on, and you'd ultimately probably have a vaccine. But we are so far from that, it's just, the field is all but dead right now, as far as I can tell. Oh, but you go look at the NIH website, and you'll see all these vaccine trials that they're supporting, phase one things. You know, 90% of them will go nowhere, and you know that when they're started. So I mean, it's nice research, but it's not development. So it's a... We have a missing link in that we don't value these things. And if you don't value them, you don't get the research to end up moving them forward. I mean, here we are, a not-for-profit group that is experts in South San Francisco, all coming out of Genentech and Chiron to make vaccines, and it's held to get the money to do it. Fascinating. Very discouraging.
Thank you so much for speaking. Sure. In addition to vaccines, do you see any help in pharmaceutical options? I know BBC recently had something on a daily pill to prevent infection, and I know there's been many other test pills in the past.
Well, look at the success. I mean, here, you've got the market for therapies driving these kinds of things. And if I had HIV infection, I'd be screaming to have a therapy too. But the power of that movement has been wonderful. I mean, the last thing I expected, to be honest, was to have a therapy for HIV beat a vaccine for HIV, because the history of that, of all the other viruses, is almost the opposite. And here, that incredible push, which we could have exactly the same thing for vaccines if we had the value there. And this wasn't a fault of the activist community, because we had lots of activists pushing for vaccines, but it just didn't have the financial oomph that the making a pill. I mean, the best thing you can do in terms, and this is going to sound a little gross, but the best thing you can do is have a very effective drug that you have to take for the rest of your life.
I actually have three questions, and they're all unrelated.
Okay.
The Thailand trial failed, and you said there was, in fact, more infections.
There was the Thambili trial in South Africa and elsewhere. It was all around the world. That failed, not ours. That was the adeno 5 vectored vaccine.
The Merck one.
Yeah. Okay. And that one failed, and not just failed. I mean, the reason they stopped it was there was a larger number of infections in the vaccinees versus the placebo.
And what was behind it? Is it because it mutates as much? Or
No. It was something that increased the susceptibility of the cells to the virus.
To what extent are they supporting funding? Because they are doing a lot of AIDS, TB, malaria work. To what extent have they played into some of the funding for any of this?
All of our movement from the private sector to a not-for-profit was supported by the Gates Foundation.
Okay.
So they said, we don't want you to stop work on this, and so they initially did all the support for that. And they're continuing. If their ideas, I mean, like this, trying to put this bigger idea together, and Gates got lots of other things. We're working on other things with Gates on other developing country things, and some of it's wonderful and some of it's chaotic like anything else, but they're a terrific player in this, in the international health field.
And my third one actually is more relevant to even Ebola. The two healthcare, you know, Dr. Brantley, I think, who were infected, they have an experimental serum that they used, but that is a cold chain process. I think it's frozen. So does a vaccine need to go through a cold chain process? Because if that's the case, how would you be able to do that? By the way, we're both pharma people, and we both worked on virus. She's actually with Gilead.
Oh.
I won't say that. We've known each other for years. She treated HIV patients.
Good. Well, Gilead's okay.
I mean, maybe I shouldn't have said that. So the cold chain process for Africa, for example, how would that?
Well, clearly the you know, some of the most successful vaccines we have moved from cold chain requiring to no non-cold chain, but still, I mean, look at, for example, smallpox. We lyophilized it, and you could leave it out in the air for years and still make a good vaccine when you reconstitute it. Polio, on the other hand, which is more maybe eradicated, it's been hell, is a live virus vaccine that requires refrigeration. But that's worked out very, very well right now, as other vaccines, in that there's wonderful simple cold chain all out in the bush. You have a strap, you have a container, and you got a cold dog, and it's all worked out remarkably well around the world. So you'd rather not. You'd rather have it be lyophilized, non-refrigerated, you know, mix it up with water and stick it any way you want. But the cold chain, because so many vaccines, especially the live virus vaccines, that they need a cold chain, and so that's established. And, you know, I don't know if you're aware, but, you know, almost all kids are vaccinated all around the world now. And that wasn't the case when I was young in this field. And that, and Gates has had a huge impact on that, as have many other institutions around the world. And it kind of followed our smallpox eradication and said, well, now we do that, let's take on something else. Then we took on polio, and I've worked on polio. And that's, smallpox was wonderful because every case of smallpox was diagnosable by any villager. There was no asymptomatic carrier. Whereas polio, you get one limping kid and you probably got 200-300 people pooping polio out at, you know, 10,000, 100,000 particles per drop of poop. And so you almost never see a chain of transmission with polio because it's all coming from asymptomatic pooping little kids. So much more difficult to find it and vaccinate. So that's been a challenge. And now all this silly war and political chaos is our enemy in public health, and all this crap going on in the Pakistan, Afghanistan areas. Polio will stay alive forever if that carries on.
First of all, thank you. And thank you to people that have dedicated their lives to or their careers to this field. I had a question about the, I think you said 1996, when Genentech wanted to drop the program. And the NIH had made a decision at that point not to fund vaccine research.
There was a clear connection between those two things, yeah. Oh, I wish I could answer that question, because I just about wrung Tony Fauci's neck when he had a committee that said, we're not sure these vaccines are going to work. Hello, why do we do studies if we knew they were going to work? It would be, you know, unethical to do a study to find out if they work. So the fact they protected chimpanzees gave us an indication, but we still had to do an efficacy trial. And this was Chiron and Genentech, the two leaders in the world vaccine, right here in the Bay Area. And there was a meeting, you know, one of these in Washington suburb meeting that we went and presented all of our data to an advisory committee of to Tony Fauci and the NIH of paying for these efficacy trials. And the advisory committee said maybe they'll work and maybe they won't, and we probably should move them ahead, and they gave it to Tony Fauci, and literally before we left the meeting, Tony Fauci said he would not fund the trials. And that's Tony Fauci, that the guy you see on TV as the head of NIAID to this day. Because he didn't think, in his estimate, that it may not work. And he didn't want to risk his whatever backside on this thing. And so then that's how we ended up having to start VaxGen and going off on our own with minimal amounts of resources, et cetera. And that carries on to this day. And he's on your TV once a week talking about some wonderful thing that he's done, but never talking about the terrible decisions that he's made. But he's charming, he's smart, and very, very politic. And politic, he probably made the right decision, maybe. But you have to have a risk-taking development organization that doesn't want to get five manuscripts out every 6 months, because vaccine studies do not get five manuscripts out. You got a double blind, so you're going to wait with nothing for 3 years, and then you're going to do a manuscript or two. That doesn't fit with the academic research institutions that NIH supports. So you've got to find another model, and we still don't have that model as of today. And Gates Foundation such is trying, but how do you make a company that will, when I could go back to Genentech and make therapeutic products and get lots and lots of money, and here we are limping along with not-for-profit vaccine things, begging money from Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. It's just out of sync. And everyone at WHO and everyone else will tell you the same thing. It's just terrible. And it's especially terrible if there's not any profit. I mean, we're working on dengue vaccine now, which actually, even though it's an equatorial disease transmitted by mosquitoes, there are various middle-income countries like Brazil that are willing to put some resources into making these vaccines. But it is, if you think about how many people get dengue every year, probably several people in this room that travel in the mosquito belt. I certainly have. Yet we're limping along with a vaccine there that looks like we have a very good vaccine. And it's moving, but it's just, as I get older, I just get less patient with this kind of bullshit.
Would you like to say a few words on Ebola?
That's a bad disease.
I'm not a biologist. I have no medical background or scientific background, but I do read a bit. And I find that nanotechnology is now being introduced into medicine as a method of targeting cells for basically eliminating them, like a guided missile. Is that anything that could come into play or has come into play in vaccine research or elimination of the HIV virus cell?
No, because it's the opposite in HIV, where the virus kills the cell that's a target, so you wouldn't want to kill those cells because that's what the virus does. So that certainly all of our work is in many ways molecular now, at the molecular basis. When you get to the nano side, then that's obviously a lot smaller, but what I would do is go upstream on that to try to figure out exactly, even though a virus is nano, how with the whole that cartoon of how it fits into the cell, how the key and the lock go, and how can you block that with either a protein, which would be nano type stuff, or with an antibody, because it's wonderful what we're, you sit down with folks at Genentech, turn Genentech loose in making vaccines, and you'll have vaccines if they could make a profit. Correct.
Especially if the business model at the end is not conducive to making
correct
profit. That seems to be the
correct
problem. I think it's slightly a bigger problem than pharmaceuticals.
Well, the pharmaceutical piece is that I can do a study for a therapy, develop a product and do a study before the vaccine has finished the first animal studies to see if it's safe and produces antibody, because you're not giving a pill and seeing if the sore throat goes away. You are giving a vaccine that requires 0, 1, and 6 month boosts. There's a year right there compared to 5 days with your pill, and you can see what the blood level is and the excretion and if it kills your target. So it is inherently slow, inherently expensive, and especially, these chimpanzees cost us $10,000 each to do a chimp study. And you probably couldn't even do it now because people want to protect chimps. We have lots of them around sitting in cages. But, I don't like to do rat studies, and I hate doing chimp studies. But when it comes to if that's the only host, you've got to do it. And so these are expensive and slow and miserable.
Technically, this virus is a little bit more complex to handle, or is
Well, I think clearly this is, if this were easy, we would have had it by now. If this were a, you know, smallpox or a non-varying hepatitis B virus that didn't have massive variation, this would have worked straight away. So this is difficult. This is maybe not flu, but it's like flu where it's changing. So a lot more resources would be required to figure this out. And so, it's a tough bug. I could conceive of having, you know, a 12-strain vaccine. If you could really work out the expression systems on these to make it relatively cheap to make 12 different strains expressed for a vaccine, maybe it's not going to be a $2 vaccine, but it'll be maybe less than $10 in today's recombinant technology. But someone's going to have to do a lot of work for that, and it's going to cost money. Yes. Sorry. There's someone in the back who wants the mic after you.
Just a quick question. I noticed, like, in the media, they've been talking about AIDS in adults, but this might sound a little bit ignorant, but how does it behave in infants or children?
Well, the AIDS in infants is almost exclusively, unless it's a hospital transfusion or something, it's almost exclusively an infected mother delivering a baby. And they're, you know, somewhere close to half in some areas of those kids will get infected, and they will all die without treatment. And there are preventions that we can use, therapeutic preventions to prevent transmission, but you have to identify the mother first. And there are programs doing that. But with a vaccine, it would be wonderful. Just shoot the little kid. Yeah.
Okay. Finally, a question about Ebola. So I heard that Ebola vaccine is available like next month.
Is that true? The vaccine? Oh, yeah, those are terrible stories. There's you talk about no financial incentive to make an Ebola vaccine. And those of us who work on Ebola would sure like to be vaccinated. But indeed, you know, I think about trying to study it, even if I had a candidate vaccine, to do a phase 3 study and say, I know these people are going to get Ebola, so I'm going to vaccinate them. You don't know who's going to have Ebola next year. So Ebola is going to be very different. Ebola, you would do your chimpanzee study or your monkey studies, and then just go out and give it to people in this setting and hope it worked, just like it did in the monkeys, because you're not going to be able to do a phase 3 study. And you're not going to get people to volunteer to be challenged with Ebola.
Sorry, is that the reason that's why it just become available?
No, the only vaccines I know are essentially under research, and they were, you know, sponsored at NIH and other places where there was some basic research going on, and now they're talking about getting it out there tomorrow. Well, that's nonsense. You talk about it. You know, no financial incentive for a company to work on Ebola. If there's not one for HIV, there certainly isn't one for Ebola.
Okay, that's fine, but there was no technical challenges.
Well, no, actually, you know, I think the technical challenges could, once you could get it into the recombinant lab, because it's certainly Ebola in your laboratory is it's a different laboratory that has to work with Ebola, because you'll die if you make a mistake there. Indeed, our lab on the first outbreak, our lab director stuck himself and came down with Ebola, luckily survived, but he remembers nothing about it. It was that bad. I mean, it's a terrible, terrible disease. But once you get it into recombinant technology, then you still have to do the animal challenge study with a live virus. And there are places that do that, but can you imagine working with a primate that you're going to stick Ebola virus into that's got claws and teeth and... those are special laboratories that have those cages. So it's not easy, but it's it'd be really fun to do, because I suspect that's a short incubation period thing. You get your studies done very quickly, and I'll bet you can make it. I mean, there's really only two strains that have been circulating, so doesn't look like it's varying that much. So I think you could make an Ebola vaccine. I just don't see how you're going to ever do an efficacy trial. And I don't know what healthcare worker would say, I will expose myself and take this vaccine. It's just, yeah.
so much for coming on this.
Sure.
Just had a really quick question. As far as, you know, overcoming the hurdle that is developing, you know, this vaccine in a large scale and being able to apply it, hopefully that's something that we see in our lifetimes, but how do you envision the vaccine, you know, going as far as, you know, genetic shift and drift,
the way for HIV?
Yes.
Yeah, that's the major issue of each one of these pieces, if the vaccines look like these pictures around the wall, and you had to make one for each one of those shapes, is it just those four there? Are you going to have to use all of these? Hopefully you could get a laboratory test that would answer that. And if you had enough resources to do primate studies, the trouble is, if it's really going to require a chimpanzee, you're probably going to go straight into humans and just do the laboratory, see if it neutralizes it in the laboratory. Because there just aren't those kind of chimpanzees around where you can do all the challenges. You'd probably do your final mix of whatever you want, maybe in a chimp, and then move into humans. But there are lots of humans still being infected with HIV, so you can do, even though there are therapies, there's still plenty of infections with HIV around. And so you could do those trials. But how you choose how many pieces you'd have to be in there, we have a lot of laboratory power now, but still you're going to have to go down to some practical evaluation and see. Because each one of those is expensive, so you don't want to waste antigen. You'd want to have the minimum number that would protect, you know, the maximum number of people.
Thanks again. This is extremely interesting. And apologies, this is a naive question, but in, let's say, trying to create something that was for multiple strains or in strains that are rapidly changing, what are some of the risks inherent in being inoculated with the vaccine that maybe it was designed to fit, in your analogy, every single picture in the room and some down the hall, so it's a little broader than perhaps even it would need to be at the most minimum case. What sort of side effects or inherent risks are there technically for the human that is vaccinated with that?
Well, there should be none from a recombinant, at least from the product itself, none. But you don't know until you actually do the trial and see if there is one strain out there that likes the antibody that you've produced against the other one, and you get an increased risk of that. And that's highly unlikely. But you can't, with any vaccine, let's say it was wonderful, it got 80% protection, the safety, you know, except for the sore arm or butt was not an issue. We then always study these vaccines until you get hundreds of thousands of people. Now the sad part about that is that when you're doing your phase 3 study, you have a placebo group and a vaccine group. And so you have a wonderful comparison. Somebody just got a shot of nothing, and the other one got the shot of the vaccine, and you can really see all the clinical, and does it hurt? Did your liver enzymes go up or whatever? But once you get it licensed, then you have all vaccinees. You don't have your placebo comparison anymore. And now you want to get millions of people to see if there's any side effects. And CDC and other organizations do that all the time. But it is very difficult because you'll always get, remember the Guillain-Barré, and I had a couple of things with hepatitis B, but were just crazy that had nothing to do with it, but you still had to do a study to try to figure out what is the incidence of this disease in expected, and what did you see in the vaccinees compared to the people who didn't get the vaccine. So it's hard, but those kind of studies are going on all the time with vaccines, and so you do have this estimate of what the side effects are. But then the reason they're so difficult is because the vaccines are so safe. And so you get these, you know, one in a million, quote, complications. And is it associated with the vaccine or is it just by chance? Because so many of them are by chance. As you can see, when you do the placebo study, you'd be surprised how many things happen in your placebo group that had nothing to do with your vaccine. But we had some really funny things in ours sometimes that people said, I think it's associated with the vaccine. And then you find out they had the placebo. You know, they got dizzy driving their motorcycle in Bangkok or something, you know.
optimistic about the future of HIV development of vaccine for HIV?
Optimistic. I'm really relatively optimistic about the technology. I'm terribly pessimistic about our society giving a shit about vaccines and moving products forward. I think we're very immature. We are therapy oriented. We do not follow the quest of a vaccine for developing countries, and we do not see the excitement that we should have for doing that. We are a retarded, preventively oriented, long-term planning country. I don't remember what I said. In terms of long-term planning and commitment for longer-term things, even past 2 years, we do not have the capability politically or economically to think that far ahead, especially for things that are not incredibly profitable.
A follow-up, actually. Thank you for your talk. Where do you see the paradigm shift happening? How is it going to happen? I mean, it does seem to me there was a point in our history where we did invest and deeply cared about vaccinations, and certainly that pendulum has really swung far.
Well, when the President of the United States got polio, we really made a polio vaccine. And until people like Ronald Reagan get AIDS, you have to use your brain, and we just don't have the long-term capability in this country, or for that matter, I think we have some in the world. The world is much, the developing world is much better at this because they see prevention as something really important. I come from Marin County, California, where the mothers are screaming about vaccinating their babies. I mean, we've become retarded in this whole field, and it's just, and our kids are going to suffer.
But how do you think that we, I mean, and I agree with you, in this country, it just seems like vaccinations are suffering a major PR problem, and it just keeps getting worse and worse and worse. Like, what are your thoughts on how we're going to get the public to really understand how science really works, particularly when it comes to something like vaccination?
Well, I think you're right. I think our marketing is relatively poor in this compared to if we, the government, were a private sector, because we're making profit on vaccines because our people are not getting sick, so we save a huge amount of money. And so we in government should be out there proselytizing and we try our best, but at least I see county health departments are so poor and state health departments are so poor that they don't have the marketing skills. And so they say, so be it. So you let what's going to happen is let the Marin County, unfortunately, it's going to be Marin County's kids who are going to come down with whooping cough 5 years from now. And then they say, oh, that's really a good vaccine. We've got to really start going. But that ends up eating 10 years and these poor kids are coughing their brains out and dying. I can say that because I'm a native of Marin County, but it just drives me nuts and I don't have the time to go talk to these ladies. I mean, and I understand they want to protect their kids, but that requires maturity. That's why you put seatbelts in, or you don't get in your car. I don't, one or the other, but don't say that I'm going to keep my kids all out of school, keep them home and not vaccinate them. Okay. And don't have any kids come to that home. There are alternatives, but not socially acceptable for the kid. And the other thing is not socially acceptable. I think these mothers that gave their kids whooping cough should unfortunately be infected themselves and see what 6 weeks of coughing your brains out is like. I mean, it's just...
All right, I think we've reached the end.
Yes.
Our thanks to Donald Francis for his talk here this evening. Our thanks to the audience for the questions.
Thank you. Great work.
Now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, celebrating its 103rd year of enlightened discussion, is adjourned.